The topic for this evening's review is cultivating loving kindness. This is the third in a series of talks about what are called the divine abidings. First talk was a general overview of the four categories: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And that talk is posted on the website. And last week's talk focused on equanimity, which is the balancing functioning of the practice. Tonight's talk is on loving kindness, which is the sort of overarching category or intention, with compassion and sympathetic joy being subcategories of that. So first, I want to read the Metta Sutta, the Discourse on Loving Kindness. He or she who wants to attain peace should practice being upright, humble, and skilled at using loving speech. He or she will practice living simply and happily, with senses calmed, without being covetous and carried away with the emotions of the majority. Let him or her not do anything that will be disapproved of by the wise ones. And this is what he or she contemplates. May we all be happy and safe, and may our hearts be filled with joy. May all living beings live in security and peace, beings who are frail or strong, tall or short, big or small, visible or not visible, near or far away, already born or yet to be born. May we all dwell in perfect tranquility. Let no one do harm to anyone. Let no one put the life of anyone in danger. Let no one, out of anger or ill will, wish anyone harm. Just as a mother loves and protects her only child at the risk of her own life, may we cultivate boundless love to offer to all living beings in the entire cosmos. May this boundless love pervade the whole universe, above, below, and across. May this love know no obstacles, and may our hearts be absolutely free from hatred or enmity. Whether standing or walking, sitting or lying down, as long as we are awake, may we maintain this mindfulness of love in our own hearts. This is the noblest way of living. Free from wrong views, greed, and sensual desires, living in beauty and realizing perfect understanding, those who practice boundless love will certainly transcend birth and death. Now, first, let me tell you a little bit about my experience. I went on my first one-week loving-kindness retreat sometime in the mid-1980s. I just reread Sharon Salzberg's book, which is becoming a classic of our era, called Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. And when I would read it, I would hear her voice speaking. It was interesting how that worked. Because it seems that before she wrote the book, and after she had gone on a several-month loving-kindness retreat to Burma, she led this one-week retreat. And it was a really important experience for me. Since then, I have been on, I think, three other ones. Another one at the Insight Meditation Society, where the first one was, and one in Taos, New Mexico, I guess there were two more at IMS. So I've had a lot of practice with loving kindness. When I came back from the Metta retreat in Taos, Metta contemplation was my primary practice for several months. Whatever I was doing, I was repeating the mantra. Could be driving the car, could be mowing the lawn, could be in session with a client. That was an organizing practice for my sense of being in relationship. So the essence of loving kindness is empathy and altruism. During previous talks, I described empathy. It's a primary function of our experience as humans. We are social animals. And there are degrees of empathy in any kind of social animal. Chimpanzees, wolves, whales, other creatures that travel in packs, perhaps even among fish, who often travel in large schools. But there's a quality of attunement that's actually built into the brain. Even though we are born with empathy, how we recognize it and how we behave is culturally determined. I've worked with many people who grew up in dysfunctional families. I certainly did. But there would be people who would come in to me, talk to me, or actually couples who would come to talk to me about troubles in their relationship. And I would ask them to describe in the session, each one of them, what it was like in their family. And the patterns of speech that they would describe, the kinds of interactions, defined what it meant to be part of a family unit. I remember early in my relationship with my wife, I had agreed to get something like a quart of milk on my way home. And I did, and I brought it home. And then when she got home from work, she said, "Did you get the quart of milk?" I said, "Yeah, I did. And thanks for reminding me." And she looked at me, she said, "Don't get sarcastic with me, Buster." "What? What are you talking about?" Well, it turns out that one of the ways that the family that she grew up in bonded was for people to be sarcastic and teasing of one another. So, as odd as it may seem, how you know you're loved to a large extent depends on how people interact, how they communicate. I also heard stories of people who said that when they were being beaten, whipped, or whatever, the parent would say, "I'm doing this because I love you. I'm doing this because I want to help you," which certainly doesn't feel like it. Doesn't seem like it. But that becomes part of our memory reservoir. And there are certain emotions that are associated with that, that have to do with feelings of security in relationships, of self-confidence, self-image, self-respect, as well as respect for others. So there's this quality of empathy that we all are born with, but we are trained in our family of origin, in larger aspects of our culture, how to identify those elements of empathy and how to behave according to them. I mentioned altruism. Altruism is a generosity. It involves putting away your own, or putting aside your own proclivities, your own inclinations to be helpful to another person. It's interesting, I was doing this research. Actually, I was rereading, I think it was Loving Kindness, Sharon Salzberg's book. And one part of it says that there was an interesting experiment that was done. And I'm aware of the experiment. It just kind of reminded me. Researchers would bring toddlers into the lab with their mother. And the researcher would be doing something that would be pretty ordinary that a child might be exposed to, and was doing this non-verbally. The example that was quoted was hanging clothes on a clothesline. And the researcher would, quote unquote, accidentally drop a clothespin. And the toddler would see that. These are pre-verbal toddlers. They can get up and move about, and they have some sense of purpose in their behavior. But the child would go and pick up the clothespin and hand it to the researcher, almost without fail. They did this experiment over and over and over again with many children. And the child would notice it, pick it up, and bring it to the researcher, who would not say thank you, would not acknowledge any kind of anything about the behavior verbally, just take the clothespin, because they didn't want to have any kind of verbal clues or cues involved in this. I can remember from my own childhood, before I was an adolescent, I was eager to help my mother wash the dishes. I would ask her, can I wash the dishes tonight? And she would very graciously allow me to do that. That all changed when I became a teenager. And, you know, I would argue with my mother for 20 minutes about 5 minutes worth of dishes. Now, I don't know where I picked that up, but that was part of my routine. Now I'm back to, you know, joyfully doing the dishes. Like Thich Nhat Hanh wrote in his book, you know, when you're doing the dishes, just do the dishes. And when you do that, it's joyful. So, quality of empathy and altruism, which is characteristic of loving kindness. I mentioned earlier that compassion and sympathetic joy are subcategories or derivatives of loving kindness. With compassion, the empathy is there and the altruism is there in the form of becoming mindful of the experience of distress and confusion. Noticing dukkha and being willing to do something to decrease the degree of distress and confusion. Now, I'll be talking about that more in depth next time we meet. That will be the topic for the next meeting, is cultivating compassion. Sympathetic joy also involves empathy and altruism. With sympathetic joy, there's an empathic attunement to someone else's happiness, someone else's success. And there's a resonance with that. You kind of go along for the ride. And to me, sympathetic joy is closely aligned with generosity. And actually, I think in Sharon's book, there's a whole chapter on that toward the end of the book. Equanimity, which is what I talked about last week, is bringing balance to the four divine abidings. There are manifestations that are called the far enemy and the near enemy of each of the four. The far enemy is the opposite. And during the guided meditation that was earlier tonight, which will be posted and found in the archives. Guided meditation on loving kindness. I described the far enemy as being aversion and ill will. Now, the characteristic of aversion is a shrinking away from unpleasant feeling. Whether it's beneficial or not, whether it's reasonable or not, when the mind interprets a particular experience as unpleasant, there's a reaction that wants to avoid it. In fact, in modern psychological terminology, it's called affect avoidance. And affect is the psychological word that describes the urgency or the potency of that avoidance, of an emotion. So you have an affect associated with sadness. So the affective aspect of sadness involves the urgency toward crying or despondency. With the opposite, with loving kindness, is what we call affect approach. Typically, affect approach involves being joyfully engaged in being kind. That's a pleasant feeling. Usually, affect approach is associated with desire. The aspect of ill will not only includes the affective experience of aversion, but also manifests as aggression. There's a lashing out, either mentally toward oneself, or verbally toward someone else, or behaviorally toward oneself and someone else. So, that's the far enemy of loving kindness. The near enemy of loving kindness is idealization or romanticizing the relationship. When I say romanticizing, I'm talking about projecting some belief or expectation on another person that they will be a certain way. In a romantic relationship, the way it plays is that, I'm going to love you because you're going to recognize my needs are, what my needs are, and you're going to give them to me without me having to ask. And that's the near enemy, because it seems like love, but typically what happens when those ideals are not met, then the affection turns to aversion and ill will. I often talk to couples about the honeymoon phase. That's a part of a relationship that is romanticized, idealized, that you find different attributes of that person that you believe, you're attached to the view that they're going to provide that need willingly every time you want it, whether you actually express that need or not. And you can see that that's not sustainable. That's when the honeymoon is over. It goes on in any relationship, not just couples, but also when you go to work or when you develop a friendship. You have a notion that this other person is going to meet your needs reliably and perfectly, and when you don't, when they don't, it feels like, your mind creates a feeling that justifies being angry or aversive or aggressive. So with the cultivation of equanimity, there are three factors in the mind that are actually three of the seven awakening factors. Mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and energy, which manifests as right effort. And those are closely aligned with equanimity. So mindfulness is investigating the experience in terms of affect approach or affect avoidance, particularly in the case of loving kindness, and discerning through, you know, investigating whether that's become the far enemy or the near enemy. And then right effort rechannels the energy of your attention and action back toward a more pure form of benevolent intention. Actually, loving kindness is a manifestation of part of the wisdom aggregate of the Eightfold Path, right intention. The other part of the wisdom aggregate is called right understanding. Your right understanding basically, in this context, means that for every cause, there's an effect. When the mind is attached to a particular idealized view of how someone should be, and they don't meet that view, they don't align with it, then the mind flips into aversion and ill will. So right effort combined with right mindfulness, actually, and right intention reorganizes that towards the true benevolent intention that we are trying to manifest. So kindness is not what we could call giving to get. We tend to do that, and this is more aligned with sympathetic joy. We tend to be generous, expecting that the other person is going to be appropriately appreciative and appropriately reciprocal. They're going to give back what we gave them plus interest. And that is obviously irrational, but people do it on a regular basis. It's part of ignorance, one of the three poisons of our experience: greed, hatred, and ignorance. It's being not being mindful, not investigating, and not applying right effort. So, another thing that's important to understand about loving kindness is that it sees through barriers. A fundamental characteristic of our subjective experience is what we call the self-object duality. The mind creates a sense of self, typically that involves a narrative. I mean, just think about the structure of language, in our case, the English language. There's a subject and an object, you know. There's a personal pronoun I and personal pronoun you. As soon as those start to operate in the brain, it creates a distinction, a separation. Now, on a social level, it is absolutely true. There is definitely a boundary between me and someone else. But that boundary tends to become rigid, tends to become idealized. The world should be the way I expect it. And the world is the object. Could be another person, could be your car, could be your hand, if your hand is not doing the right thing, right? So there's this separation that the mind creates, typically through narrative. Loving kindness is meant to see past that, to cultivate a sense of connection, a dissolution of the self-other process. This is why it's called divine abiding. The notion that there's a quality of attention that can be cultivated that reveals the true nature of Brahma. Divine abidings are typically called the Brahma Viharas. Brahma basically is the Hindu equivalent of God, or in Islamic terms, Allah. And Vihara basically means a dwelling or an abode. Interestingly, the contemporary Indian state of Bihar is the modern rendering of the word Vihara. And Bihar apparently is, the Buddha spent a lot of time in that part of India during his life. Curious little side story there. So, loving kindness fosters a realization of anatta, the absence of an enduring autonomous self. Now, the true realization of that is nirvana. But cultivating the Brahma Viharas, the ability to resonate with the dwelling of the gods, so to speak, moves us in that direction toward the process of awakening. And as I said a few minutes ago, it actually, you know, is part of the wisdom aggregate of the Noble Eightfold Path. So, as I said earlier, loving kindness is the antidote for fear, anger, resentment, and for disregard for your own self-worth. Once again, in Sharon's book, she talks about being on retreat and had an interview with her teacher, and he asked her a question. If you were confronted with a choice where you had to decide if somebody had to die, whether it was going to be you or this other person, who would be more deserving of life? And she had been several weeks into the retreat by that time, and she couldn't answer him. She could not say who was more deserving of survival. And after some puzzlement, he actually said to her, "You're right. You can't make that distinction between who's more deserving of life. However, you can make a decision to sacrifice your own life for the benefit of another. That doesn't mean you don't deserve to live. It doesn't mean you don't deserve to be happy or healthy or content." So, those of you who know me know that I love to do research on how these different mind states that Buddhism talks about are processed in the brain. What goes on in the brain when there's empathy or altruism or loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy? Well, I was going to quote some things out of an article, the neuroscience of this, but I decided that would be way too lengthy and mind-boggling. So basically, the parts of the brain that are associated with emotion, initiating behavior, making the distinction between what is in one's body and what is outside of one's body, empathy, altruism, and decision-making, executive function, are all associated with loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. As I mentioned earlier, you know, as social animals, cultivating these sorts of behaviors has real survival value, not just for an individual, but for society at large. And I'm saying this, what comes to mind is something that I discovered some years ago. You know, Charles Darwin is acknowledged as being the person who instigated the notion of evolution, evolutionary theory. And the term that was used was survival of the fittest. Now, Darwin's work was not well received in the last half of the 19th century, which was also the onset of what was called the Gilded Age, which actually endured from the late 1800s right up to probably World War I and the aftermath of World War I. But part of that involved a certain kind of philosophy that supported colonialism and capitalism. And so survival of the fittest was interpreted as meaning the biggest and meanest and strongest would be the ones who survived. And that's what I grew up with. That's what I was taught when I was in school back in the 1950s and 1960s. It turns out that that's not really accurate. The fittest basically means those entities that most elegantly fit into a system. In this case, we're talking about the ecosystem. Now think about the troubles that we're having now ecologically, right? Greed, hatred, and ignorance. Devastation of the environment, political conflict. All of these are, you know, organized around the notion of survival of the fittest. If the other animals were more fit, they would survive. It turns out that when you destroy one particular part of an ecological niche, it affects all the other creatures in that niche. If you get rid of the wolves, you end up having too many deer. You have too many deer, it, you know, disrupts the environment. You get too many ticks, too many insects, or you know, destroy all the foliage in an area. So survival of the fittest really is more about loving kindness and, you know, the ability to understand what the most harmonious, most fitting behavior would be in a setting. So the other thing that I want to emphasize is something that I alluded to briefly in the guided meditation, not specifically, but I've talked about it in the most recent talks, the vagus nerve. Vagus nerve is the biggest nerve in the body. It extends from the base of the brain and radiates out into the torso, all the way down to the lining of the intestines. The reason it's called vagus, it's derived, as many of these terms are, from Latin, and it basically means differentiated or dispersed, scattered, because it reaches out. If you go to Wikipedia and you look at the images, it comes down and kind of scatters all around to the throat, the lungs, the heart, other organs, the intestines, and then nerve goes back up to the brain. Now, why is this relevant to loving kindness? Well, there's actually been research done on this. It's what is called vagal tone. Vagal tone is associated with a balance of energy going from the brain down into the body and from the body going back up into the brain, basically saying, we're all good here. You know, the body's not in pain, that's good. Or the brain is not stressed out, this is good. And it turns out that regular practice of mindfulness meditation enhances vagal tone. It also turns out that the regular practice of loving kindness meditation enhances vagal tone. Now, one of the beneficial side effects of vagal tone is called social engagement. It means the ability to feel comfortable socially or interacting with others, to have confidence, to have empathy, to be altruistic. Daniel Goleman actually wrote about this in several books around the topic of what's called emotional intelligence. He doesn't mention Buddhism at all in any of these books. But Daniel Goleman has been very involved with Buddhism for his entire adulthood. So it's woven into the fabric of what he describes. Involves self-awareness, self-regulation, empathy, the ability to negotiate needs in a relationship, to put off gratification, to reach a higher goal, so forth and so on. So that's vagal tone. Another way we describe dukkha is something I've talked about before, is distress and confusion. Now, distress is something that's typically experienced in the body. Cortisol is a hormone that activates the body to defend it against injury, against aggression, and it's associated with stress. And stress upsets the immune system, upsets metabolism, so forth and so on, particularly if it's ongoing. That's distress. Confusion has to do with the way the mind misrepresents reality, misrepresents expectations. I've talked about this before in terms of idealizing what could happen in a relationship. Not just a relationship with other people, but a relationship with animals or a relationship with the environment. So this confusion, this misperception of how to be in the world integrates or interacts with the stress in the body. And this is what creates dukkha. I'm using modern psychological terms to describe this. And I call this self-state conflict. I've used these terms before. What our regular practice of mindfulness meditation, now we conclude into that the practice of loving kindness and the other parts of the divine abidings, provides relief from that distress and confusion, from that self-state conflict, and that manifests as self-state integration, which is another way to describe vagal tone. So that's another beneficial side effect of cultivation of loving kindness. The next thing is something I also mentioned earlier, which is the essential function of verbalizing in terms of creating a sense of self, the ego. Part of what goes on with pre-verbal children is they do not have a sense of separation, or it's very minimal. And so when they learn language, they learn to have an ego. And the words that we use to describe experience have emotional connotations, emotional impacts. The example I use in the paper that's going to be posted with this talk is something I've used before. If you grew up having pleasant experiences with a dog, if you hear a dog bark or a dog comes into your presence, it's going to stimulate certain kinds of affect approach experiences. You're going to feel happiness, joy, you're going to want to engage with the animal, so forth and so on. Alternatively, if you had unfortunate experiences with a dog earlier in your life, you were frightened or injured, traumatized, then the word dog or the sound of a dog barking is going to produce a narrative that's associated with fear and aggression, and be very stressful. So I'm using that as an example to describe elements of the loving kindness mantra. Now, those of you who participated in the earlier guided meditation, which will be posted and archived soon, I'll repeat the elements of the mantra. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be content. May I love myself sincerely and with gently patient kindness, just as I am now, no matter what happens. The first four phrases are sort of the meat of this. The word safe has certain kind of emotional connotations. It means unguarded, relaxed, at ease, non-defensive, other kinds of connotations. And there are emotional, hormonal processes that are initiated by that. Whenever we think a particular thought, it sends a signal out into the bloodstream, a hormonal signal, that either tenses up the muscles, ready for action, or relaxes the muscles. And those are driven by hormones. So when you repeat the word safe, it counters any feelings of being unsafe or guarded or defended or insecure. So what you're doing is you're building a reservoir of affective responses that are benevolent, that are approachable. Same with the word happy or healthy or content. So that is what happens neurologically and hormonally. When you sincerely, it's another one of the words in there, repeat the phrases. And of course, we all idealize our practice. I want to be the perfect meditator. I want to do this just right. I want to be the first kid on my block to be awakened, right? So we all have this kind of idealized notion of our meditation practice. And speaking for myself, I have not really gotten there yet. You notice the word yet. I still have aspirations. But it's important to realize that we judge ourselves, even about our meditation practice. So that's why I tagged on, after many years of loving-kindness meditation practice, that final phrasing, just as I am now, no matter what happens. May I love myself sincerely and with gently patient kindness. Not judgmentalism, not harshness, not despair, not frustration, not with self-doubt. I'm going to keep practicing. I'm going to keep perfecting this. Keep purifying the intention. So that phrasing has a purpose. Now, what I tell meditation students who want to take up loving kindness practice, I'm giving you a formula. The formula that I was given on my first retreat with Sharon was, may I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be content. That's the basic. Like I said, that's the meat of it. The other parts of it got elaborated in, and she told us at the beginning of the retreat, and she actually says this in the loving kindness book. You have to make this your own. This has to be an authentic manifestation of how you want yourself to experience your life. Now, one of the things that happens when we do something like this is it's easy to slide into rote memory. May I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be content, blah, 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 blah. And I've done that. As soon as I'm mindful of it through investigation, I make the right effort to go back to the heart, go back to sincerity. Now, I mentioned the vagus nerve earlier. Perhaps this illustrates why I encourage people to pay attention to their heart. I did this when I was teaching people loving kindness meditation before I knew about the function of the vagus nerve, because I wanted people to have some kind of embodied experience. And I know from my own retreat experience, 3 or 4 days into the retreat, something happens in the middle of my chest. I don't even really need the mantra anymore. It's just this, all I have to do is kind of intend for love or compassion or sympathetic joy. And it's there. It's open. It's operating. But you have to kind of, you know, kickstart the process. And that's what the mantra is for. But what it's doing is it's activating vagal tone. And that feeling of joy is what is manifesting this joy. Now, I completed my annual self-retreat at the end of December, and this retreat, I've had some difficult retreats recently, did not stop me from going on retreats, did not discourage me, but this last retreat was pretty joyful. And afterwards, I'm recruiting people for an intensive study group, and the focus of the study group is going to be loving kindness, because it certainly is a time in our culture when people would benefit from counteracting aversion and ill will. Started practicing loving kindness meditation for my daily morning meditation. I've been doing that for the last couple of weeks. Well, I was out walking with my dog, and she and I take a regular route. You know, it's convenient for her, it's convenient for me. And I was just turning the corner to walk down what's called Linden Street in my neighborhood, and I had this feeling of joy well up. You know, it was, I was walking mindfully. I don't think I was really doing the loving kindness meditation, but this feeling of joy just welled up and filled up my chest. It just felt like my chest was swelling. And tears started to pour down my cheeks, and I started to giggle in a weird kind of way. And this went on, and I just tuned into it. This is sort of what sympathetic joy practice is like. You just be curious about it, open up the valves, let it flow, be with it. So for several hundred yards, probably about 200 yards, maybe 300 yards, I was open to this feeling of joy. And my belief is that the development of my meditation practice from this last retreat, combined with the metta practice that I've been doing routinely for the last few weeks, which is basically January, right after the retreat, produced this feeling. It hasn't happened since then, but I know that it happens. And I do feel a lot more joy lately than I have in the past. It's easier to access. And that's what comes about when you cultivate loving kindness. Now, I put into the notes a lot of information about how to cultivate loving kindness, derived from the notes that I gave out to people in the introductory loving kindness courses that I've taught over the last couple of decades, which I haven't taught over the last couple of years because of the pandemic. So there's more you can read there about the practice. But those of you who participated in the guided loving kindness meditation prior to this talk, you'll discover that the elements of what in the notes are kind of woven into the fabric of the guided meditation. Different topics to contemplate, different ways to deal with distraction, so forth and so on. And I also included at the very end of the notes, two pages that have the various renderings of loving kindness. So I'm just going to quickly review that. There's the basic one, which I just recited for you. But then there's a different rendition where you focus on another person. And you can focus that in two different phrasings. May you be safe. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be content. May you love yourself sincerely and with gently patient kindness, just as you are now, no matter what happens. Or may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be content. May I love you sincerely and with gently patient kindness, just as you are now, no matter what happens. Now, the second rendition is oriented toward your relationships with people in your imagination while you're meditating, with whom you have some conflicted experiences, some difficulties. And there's a progression. There's the person you admire and respect, it's easy to generate toward them. There's a neutral person. There's a person toward whom you have mixed feelings. And there's a person toward whom you have very uncomfortable feelings. So there's that progression. So there's a variety of renderings in here regarding that. And then, not in the notes, there's another radiance contemplation, which basically means you imagine that your heart is glowing, like the center of a radiant sphere that can extend out beyond the boundaries of your body. And everywhere that intention goes, you're generating loving kindness toward everybody in your vicinity, everybody in your neighborhood, everybody in your state, everybody in your country, everybody in the world. And there's another similar contemplation which involves all the creatures that we cohabit this planet with. Creatures great and small, near and far, so forth and so on. So all of these are meant to engender a feeling of communion, of cooperation, of benevolent intention. And this will be explored further when I talk about compassion next week. And then in following talks will be about sympathetic joy. I've already talked about equanimity. That was last week. Okay. So now the time is here for questions or comments about what you have, what you experienced if you participated in the guided meditation, or anything you heard me say tonight. Julian, yes, sir.
Hi, Peter. Hi, everyone. Thank you for the teaching and guided meditation. I have a question. Well, it's not a question, but yeah. So my question is, this metta practice, especially, for example, I think what you mentioned about Sharon going to Burma to practice for months, is it a concentration practice or is it kind of insight if you practice for a long period of times? And then the comment is about the guided meditation. When you suggested us to focus on the central part, diaphragm near the heart area, for me it was difficult to concentrate in that area and at the same time repeating the phrases of wishing well and happiness and safety and health and all these good wishes. So I just kept repeating the mantras, and I didn't pay much attention about focusing on trying to sense something in here. At the end of the practice, it was, as you said, like just a feeling of really like wishing well to the different beings.
So answering your first question, that particular retreat that Sharon went to was devoted to cultivating the Brahmaviharas. I think it was several months long. So, but cultivating loving kindness is considered to be a concentration practice. It's a way to concentrate the mind or to unify the mind. Also, I mentioned that loving kindness is a manifestation of benevolent intention, part of the wisdom aggregate. The other part of the wisdom aggregate is right understanding, and that's insight. That's vipassana. So, you, in a sense, you cannot practice vipassana without benevolent intention. You cannot cultivate benevolent intention without insight. To answer your second question, it comes with practice. Just now I was remembering, I went to a folk festival back in the 1970s up in Pennsylvania. And there was a person who was singing, playing the fiddle, and clogging all at the same time. That was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Talk about multitasking. And he was good at it. I don't remember the fellow's name. He was pretty famous performer. But basically what you do is you, what I do is rapidly alternate back and forth between what's going on in my chest and the mantra. And after a while, they become aligned. And I also try to coordinate the mantra with my breathing. So I am multitasking. But what happens is they kind of blend over time so that you can be aware of sincerely repeating the mantra and aware of being alert to what you might notice in your chest and aware of the relationship between your breathing cycle and the repetition of the mantra. And sometimes I repeat parts of the phrase every out-breath, which I alluded to in the guided meditation. Other times, I put more of my attention on the mantra, the sincerity, sincere repeating of the mantra, but still noticing the breath sensation. And for me, that is kind of blending the wisdom aggregate, right understanding and right intention. The right understanding is the mindfulness of breathing. The right intention is the loving kindness part. So when I'm practicing mindfulness of breathing, it's easier for it to be heartfelt, shall I say? And when I'm practicing loving kindness meditation, I'm more inclined to be mindful of what's going on, not just going through rote repetition. Okay? Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Welcome. Other questions or comments? Lily?
I wanted to share something and I wanted to ask a question. So the sharing part is that I've been doing it for 2 weeks, I think, the loving kindness now. And today, I have my two young boys, 5 years old and 18 months, and today we were playing together. And they're in the phase that they're taking toys away from each other and, kids. And I felt, bubbling it up and all these things. And then I started doing my mantra. But rather than doing it just silent for myself, I started saying it. And I altered it a little bit. And I started with, may I be patient, may I be joyful, may I be healthy, and may I be content, and so on. And my older one started to repeat it with me, which I was very much surprised. Because suddenly, we were playing together and he was repeating. I didn't even ask him to repeat. But I thought that was so cool because, just the whole presenting it and then, repeating it. And I think he even asked me something about it, but I'm not sure. Either way, that was the sharing part.
So let me answer that first, then you ask me your second, you ask me your question. Mm-hmm. You've heard me talk about mentalizing before. Mm-hmm. And that involves the adult on the site, typically a parent, elaborating on what they're feeling and what they're doing and why they're feeling it and why they're doing it. So one of the things you could do with your son, I encourage you to keep doing that with him, and then help him understand what those words mean. What does patience mean? How do you know you're being patient? Why should you be patient? What kind of situation is it important to be patient with? That will help him a lot.
We talk a lot about that, and also, when I'm not patient, I explain why I'm not patient. So he's very mature for his age, which I have to admit, in that sense, he is very aware of his feelings, and not always, but, often. So my question is, I'm still in the process of building up my time to be at the 45 minutes, as I mentioned to you in our conversation prior. So I was wondering, I'm still only doing it towards myself, because in the Sharon Salzberg book, she puts a lot of emphasis on, in order to be, to feel the loving kindness and be compassionate to others, you have to build it for yourself. And I noticed in the past that I was always skipping myself. I wanted to make sure that everybody else, gets into my meditation, but not me. So I still do the 20 minutes now. So I was wondering how long should I keep doing just myself and switch to another person?
I would encourage you to do it just for yourself for the next couple of weeks.
Until we start the study
Yeah.
group.
Now, if spontaneously other people come to mind, okay, that's fine. But set the intention that you're primarily going to be cultivating this feeling, building a reservoir of benevolent intention. From that flows all the benevolent intention toward others. It's a kind of a different manifestation of empathy. One of the things that's important is that empathy is a two-way street. What I mean by that is, if you're upset, other people will empathize with that. Whether they're consciously aware of it or can manage it well or not, they are being affected by your upset. Alternatively, if you're manifesting loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy, and another person is upset, your expression, the more purely you radiate it, the more confident you are about your ability to access it and manifest it, the more they will empathize with that, whether they're consciously aware of it or not. There's this parable from the New Testament. Jesus is with some of the disciples on the Sea of Galilee, and a great storm comes up. And Jesus is resting below decks. I think he's down there meditating myself. But a great storm comes up, and they're all afraid they're going to die. And Jesus comes up and he calms the storm, right? To me, that's a parable that's associated with he's bringing loving kindness to a fearful experience that his apostles are struggling with. And they are empathically, affected by his behavior, his mood. And there's all kinds of stories about people being in the presence of a holy person and how it significantly impacts them. So that's why I encourage you, do the loving kindness meditation focused on yourself so you build a really strong core of that. Okay?
Thank
Welcome.
you.
Other questions or comments about loving kindness practice? Yes, John.
The loving kindness is kind of like a glow. If you blow on a charcoal, it glows, it gets more bright. And as you sit with that within yourself, you'll start radiating it. And people pick it up. I find that to be my favorite meditation because everybody thinks in words. And if you're doing both, then sometimes your signals get, you don't get as much of that feeling when you really start generating, because you're generating it whether you like it or not. It's just whether you're tuning into it. You know what I mean? You're blocking it with all that crossfire of those thoughts in words. So good luck. I think you'll have a blast tuning in,
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? All right, let's have our closing meditation, and I'm going to let you all in on a secret. Something, oh, Sharon, I'm sorry, I didn't notice that. Go ahead.
I was muted. I didn't realize it. I just want to say briefly that without loving kindness, I don't think it's possible to follow the Noble Eightfold Path with right speech and all of the other wholesome things that we strive for. So I consider loving kindness within my practice to be the core of all of the others.
Right. Yeah, loving kindness is right intention, and right intention combined with right understanding informs right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And our ability to manifest wisdom and virtue comes about as a result of the discipline from right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So you're spot on with that, Sharon.
Thank you for your talk.
Welcome. So here's the secret. For 30 years now, I've been doing these Dharma talks, and there's a silent meditation at the end of each one. I am practicing loving kindness meditation every time I do that. So I've been doing this for umpty-ump years now. So just so that you all are clued into this. And here's what I say. May we all be happy and peaceful with an ease of well-being. So that's what I say when we have our brief closing meditation. So I invite you all to consider doing that as well for the rest of your life. So let's sit. I wish you well, folks, and I hope that we are all safe and reasonably happy until the next time we have a chance to meet.